You're telling me lies, you're putting me down, you're starting to make me cry. You told me this morning you love me so, but still I know you lie.
Okay, so I am here with Robin Black, who is the author of If I Loved You, I Would Tell You This. Robin, how are you doing?
I'm doing well, thank you.
Thank you for being here. It's a pleasure to talk.
Pleasure to be here.
The first thing I want to ask before I get into absolute nitty-gritty here is the way that all of these stories were written. 8 years, 10 stories. This leads me to believe, and perhaps you could confirm or deny or expand upon my speculation, that you need time to really ruminate upon a story before you write it. What goes into writing one of these stories?
I think that it's possible that the rumination actually occurs at the keyboard.
Uh-huh.
I'm somebody who, I think by a conservative estimate, I probably discard 75% of what I write.
Yeah.
So it's a combination of my fingers constantly moving, and my having a certain awareness of the fact that that doesn't mean that everything that's coming out is worth keeping. So it's, I don't pre-think stories at all. I actually do quite the opposite. I'm a pretty firm believer in the idea that if I'm not surprised by what happens in the story as I write it, it's quite unlikely that a reader will be surprised as they read it.
Yeah.
So I really try to avoid plotting things out. The other reason I will say, I don't know if I should say in self-defense, but it's close to that, is I was also working on a lot of other things at the same time. So I wrote some essays, and I wrote a novel, and I raised 3 children. But also wrote a lot of bad stories.
Yeah.
That went into writing 10 that I felt were decent enough for
this. How many bad stories? Yeah.
I think that if you count just the ones I completed, there are probably 25 others. And if you count the others that I started and got anywhere from 2 to 20 pages into, there are probably another 24 of those. So a lot. I produce a lot of pages. I like a very low percentage of them.
This is interesting that you do all your thinking at the keyboard, because the character relationships in many of these stories are quite intricate and quite connected. I guess, do you figure out these relationships over the course of writing? How does this work exactly? Expand upon the rumination.
Where does it all come from? None of it's autobiographical. I always feel I have to start there. So I'm not one of these people who thinks, you know, wow, this thing that just happened to me would make a great story. And to the extent that I ever think that, I put that into memoir. So if I write about myself, I'm really writing about myself. These things are all made up. I said a lot of it happens at the keyboard. What I should actually more accurately say is I also do a lot of my writing while I'm doing the dishes, though my husband may laugh at the idea that I ever do the dishes. But, you know, while I'm walking, I'm not somebody who thinks that everyone needs a regimen of sitting down and writing a certain amount of time, because a lot of my writing happens away. I'll just be thinking about the people in the stories really as though they were friends of mine, and I was just sort of trying to figure out what the heck they were going to do with their lives.
Yeah.
And so it's a lot of kind of just thinking through human psychology that goes into it.
You mentioned not wanting to lift from reality, and this is interesting to me because I noted that in these stories you really go out of your way to avoid extremely explicit metaphors, save in 2 stories. In Tableau Vivant, you of course have the scarf, and If I Loved You has the fence. I'm wondering if the scarf and the fence came about as a way of knowing the characters, or a way of, I suppose, moving the characters on the chessboard while you were doing the dishes, or what happened here?
The scarf in Tableau Vivant is complete invention.
Yeah.
The fence is not. We actually have a neighbor who built a fence in our driveway.
Huh.
And in pondering how to write about it, because it was one of those events that struck me as so peculiar that somebody would just move into a neighborhood and sort of start tromping on their neighbors. It seemed like such an odd character defect, I guess, in a human being. I thought, well, I'll write an essay about it, you know, what's it like to have a horrible human being move in next to you? And then I thought, well, I don't really want to write an essay about it. I'll write a story about it. But again, I don't write about myself. So the only thing in there that's true is that there was a fence. And the other piece of truth was my impulse in the story to say to this man, how can you just be this mean to people when you have no idea what the meaning of this is to them? And there's actually a sort of funny story about it. When that story was published in the Southern Review, and in the story, the woman whose fence it is dying a very sad, terrible death. And when Brett Lott, who was then editing the review, called me up to say they had taken it, I was all excited, and I said, the first words out of my mouth were, oh, I can't wait to throw a copy of it over that damn fence. And there was this terrible pause, and I realized that he was trying to figure out how much of it was true.
Yeah.
And I said, oh, no, I'm not dying. There just is a fence. It's not, you know. So often my stories will have a tiny real element among them, and I'll kind of build a universe around that.
Yeah. Do you feel reticence with taking a element from reality and plucking it in? I mean, should this even matter if the story itself works on some particular level, like as this one does?
I don't, like, on the element of self-exposure or of any of that. And in fact, in memoir, I tell people quite a lot about my life. Where I feel exposed in stories has more to do with what I make up. Because I think that, you know, when you write a personal essay, you have a lot of control over what you're telling people. I can say, well, I will disclose this about my parental relationship. I will disclose this about my feelings about religion. When you write stories, what you're really exposing are your obsessions. And it's much more like showing somebody your dreams. What you make up, I think, is infinitely more personal than what you choose to recount from your own life.
Yeah, yeah. Well, I also wanted to talk about Harriet Elliott. There's some interesting terminology in this story. You have Self-Expression Day. You have Resolution Day instead of Veterans Day, which is also interesting because it used to be known as Armistice Day.
Right.
And when the narrator meets Harriet's father, I found this interesting because the narrator remarks that there was something vaguely wrong with the father who answered the door and took your coat, who spoke to you as though you were interesting. This difference between what the narrator is willing to accept within this crazy school versus this perceived strangeness in reality offers a particular tension, and also gets us into the ongoing theme within your work, which is how do you negotiate that gray area between two extremes. But this story is interesting because there is that explicit terminology, there the explicit initial caps, and I'm curious why this story, above all the other ones, tended to rely more on, I suppose, explicitness and resisting explicitness.
And a kind of social commentary,
yes,
I guess. Well, I had sent my children to Quaker school, and I had been, frankly, disillusioned with the discrepancy between the terminology of Quaker school, which is, you know, there is that of God in everyone, and everyone is, you know, the assumption is we're all going to be very nice to each other. And the reality of the fact that the children were making the same fun of each other that they were making at the other schools where my kids had been. And I also, I guess I'm of a generation of parents. My first child was born in 1988. I'm of a generation which is often characterized as the sort of the helicopter parents, the ones who hover over their children. And I've always had a somewhat cynical view of all that. And at the same time, I myself am of a generation from the progressive school experiments.
Yeah.
So I think in that terminology, a lot of my perhaps not so attractive contempt for all of those things comes through, I'm depicting a society of people who take themselves very seriously and give themselves a language in which to take themselves very seriously. So when they call Veterans Day Resolution Day, or when they call Show and Tell Self-Expression Day, it's a sort of invention of what to me has always seemed like a fairly self-congratulatory way of negotiating the things that all the rest of us are negotiating anyway.
Yeah. But it's also interesting because to expand upon this further, you have these efforts to understand other people by the degree of belief you place within their particular stories. In Harriet Elliott, the title character claims she was kidnapped by Italians when she was 3. In The Guide, you have this interesting faith that Jack has in her daughter that she won't detect certain aspects of his life. I don't want to give that actual story away. The attempts to find cause for inexplicable behavior often. The opening of Gaining Ground, the narrator makes efforts to connect her electrician's deficiencies to her father's death. And I'm curious, just from a creative standpoint, how this tension between belief and our stories translates into the creation of a particular narrative, why this seems to fuel your stories in a very particular way.
I think a lot of it is unconscious, and it's one of those things where as an author you go back and you read it and you go, wow, you know, I really am into this discrepancy between the perceived and the actual. There's a lot of that going on here. I think that I was one of these kids, and I actually end up thinking it's true of a lot of writers, where what you actually think is going on in your family is not the acceptable myth of what's going on in your family.
Yeah.
I actually believe that, although it's true of a lot of people who aren't writers as well, I think it's true of every writer I've ever met that at some point in their life they felt significantly silenced by something. There was something they weren't supposed to see or admit they had seen. And there's a lot of that in my work that comes through, I think. And I think that in essence, you know, not to get too meta about it, but the actual act of writing these stories is a kind of whistleblowing and saying, okay, folks, all those things you think are not being perceived, all these secret lives we're all living, all these things we're not saying to each other, they're the reality. And this whole conversation that's going on is something that is a construct, is something that we're all creating in order to get from day to day and because we want our lives to be a particular way. But I do think there's a lot in a big tension in my stories between how people hope and think and hope they are conveying their lives are and what their lives really are. And that is an area that creatively I'm fascinated with.
Certainly, but on the other hand, you are responsible for what your characters say, and I will cite two specific examples from two stories. there's a very interesting, cold, and clinical approach to birth and death at times. Gaining Ground, the box went in the way it was supposed to. The history in the world, having children in two-year intervals. I read this and I said to myself, boy, my goodness, this is an extremely impassive way of referring to something that is so inherent to our being. And so I must ask, in these two instances, you're responsible for those words.
Yes.
They're from a very personal place in both of these particular stories. And so what is your response to that?
I think for a woman who is as sentimental as I am, and many people come out reading these stories and the rap on them is, you know, oh, they're emotional, they're about the life of the emotions, and they often get categorized with women, you know, women writers, and it's all very about the human heart. I actually think I have a quite cold intellectual take on some of it. I mean, I think I'm always surprised when I'm compared to female writers who I think of as being a little more soft and sentimental, because I don't think these are sentimental stories.
Yeah.
I think you're quite right that there's a there's an element almost of coldness. In my real life, I'm not a cold person, but I've been through a lot of tragic events, and I've witnessed a lot of difficulties and illnesses and deaths. And I think that there is a part of me that is impatient with the idea that these things are somehow unusual. I think for me they are every day, that the business of loss, the business of death, and I don't think that makes me an unsympathetic person, but I also will say from an artistic perspective, you also have to be very careful when you're writing about dying and birth and illness, that to tread into the sort of sentimental representations of those things is to undersell them in a way, because we're all so guarded against the mushiness. And so I have been careful in the stories about where I deploy sentiment and where I don't. And I think as you've read the stories, the character in them, not in terms of biography, but in terms of outlook, the one I'm most like is Clara, the portrait painter.
Yeah.
And she was the one where when I wrote the story, I thought, oh, that's me. And I mean, in part because she is a portrait painter and deals with the question of representing human beings, which is what I do, but also because she's a woman who has a great capacity for love and connection and also a fairly wide, defended, cynical streak. And I think for better and worse, I do as well.
Well, then that leads me to wonder if you identify closest with Clara. At the beginning of that particular story, she says, well, I have no problems reading the face. It's just expressing how that face looks onto a painting that I have the issue with. This leads me to ask you, but I think I'll refrain from it until we kind of go through this point,
okay,
about whether you face a similar creative struggle with many of these stories in terms of being able to observe limitless possible forms of human behavior and trying to corral it into this, you know, the neatness of narrative. I mean, life doesn't always match up that way. So do you face a similar struggle? Is this why these stories took so long? Or?
I think that that's part of it. I think, and I actually blogged about this recently on the Story Prize blog about why I connect I'll connect your question to the question of why my stories have grown longer and longer over the years. And I think that there has been a shift in me as a writer between feeling the constraints of the short story form, where they really say, you know, everything must be necessary and everything must run toward the same end, to not being as disciplined in that way, because I'm not sure that I know what is necessary. And I see these, you know, many observations about people, and sometimes something won't seem exactly necessary to the story, but some instinct will tell me it's relevant, so I'll put it in. And my honing discipline has become a lot less disciplined over time, so that I will put in more and more, and I begin to see more and more gestures that people make, more and more little facts about them as being relevant to whatever the sort of central project of the story is.
This leads me to also continuing on with the face, which is throughout these stories. I'll cite numerous examples of that in just a bit. But I'm curious if the character's relationship with another person's face or perhaps another object, or perhaps an essential part of some other being, is really the way with which to, I suppose, corral this giant anarchy of narrative. To talk about the face, I'll just give you a number of examples. In Immortalizing John Parker, Clara experiences a discrepancy between her ongoing passion for, as we just said, for studying faces and the time it takes to make the photo. In Harriet Elliott, there's a moment where Harriet's face is closer to the narrator's than it had ever been before. In a county where you once lived, Jeremy watches Kathleen's face on the train, noting a network of thin lines remains, lines that weren't there a decade before. So it's almost as if these characters can't read what's before them, what is so obvious before them. It's like this: here is this great map of a face, and they are incapable of really comprehending that meaning, that emotional meaning to their own particular lives. And so, the giant question, I know, but I'm curious if such proximity with another human being as a way to basically solve this problem you mentioned in your last answer?
Well, the first thing I'll say is when I started writing, I was terrible at all physical descriptions. And somebody once described an early story of mine as being like trapped underwater with two giant brains talking to each other. And my response was, well, at least they're giant brains, you know, and at least they're smart. But so I've worked very hard on depictions of all physical things. I mean, I didn't have people in settings. I didn't have landscapes. You never knew what these people looked like. And I think that, so there's been a kind of just elevation of that in my work, of trying to really do that. It's, with the faces in particular, I think in part it's a way of getting into the head of the person who's looking at the person. Because when you're describing a character and you describe what they see, as much as you're describing the thing itself that they're looking at, you're revealing what it is that the character is likely to notice. So when Jeremy looks at Kathleen's face in that moment, what he's seeing is that she is older than she used to be. And it does say a lot about him that that's where he's focused on. So in a sense, I guess, if I'm understanding the question correctly, all those physical objects and all the descriptions are ways of narrowing in on the character who is making the observation, so that you have a focus on their focus. This is what they notice, and that's who they are. And we do look at each other's faces. I mean, we just do.
Yeah. But does that permit you a form of devising the narrative in a more precise manner? There's something along the lines of this relationship with another's face, that you need that kind of, I suppose, human trajectory with which to figure out what a story ultimately, where it goes and what it means and the like?
There's some of that. There's also, I'm very conscious in stories of the symbolic scheme in the story. I'm very, very conscious of that, that stories are comprised of many, many, many elements, and one of them is plot on the sort of what happens level. And one of the things that makes what happens meaningful is that at the same time that what happens is happening, the author is manipulating a series of symbols and metaphors and all of that. So I mean, the objects that are in my stories are very purposely in there, sometimes in a way to tell on a symbolic level a story that has some tension with the one which is what is actually happening. So it's all a way in the end of telling the same story, you know, but it just happens on many different levels.
Mm-hmm. I wanted to bring up sex, not only because it's a great topic to bring up, but it's often hidden within these stories. I found this to be very interesting. It's never explicitly stated.
It's not a super dirty book.
Oh yeah, well.
But there's some.
Well, let me describe. In Tableau Vivant, when the children were teenagers, she had dealt with their sexual activities, and then later we hear the chord of two voices upstairs. In a country where we once lived, you have Kathleen and Jeremy drunkenly stumbling into a sexual encounter, and I believe that's the words sexual encounter in another story, which I found interesting. But then later in the story, you broach the topic of cybersex between Jeremy and his current lover, Rose, and Rose gasps from behind a curtain of shimmering color blocks. So sex is interesting because how it is heard and how it is seen or how it is even obliquely referred to is more important than how it is felt, how it is experienced by these particular characters. And I'm curious as to why this interesting carnal reticence continues amongst these, or not specifically reticence, but more of an oblique way of presenting.
It's alluded to rather than really depicted. There are a couple things at work there. I mean, one is that I haven't, it's not shyness. It's not a reluctance to do it because I, you know, am worried about it. It's it's a very difficult thing to depict, and one of the reasons it's difficult is because, and this gets to a larger topic in my work, which is sort of the defamiliarization of the familiar. Everyone who reads this book thinks they know what sex is. The minute you say sex, they have a whole entire imagined universe of what that is. And part of my job as a writer of these stories and other works might be different, is to use that knowledge that they have and give the reader just enough to kind of fill in the blanks, as opposed to using a kind of explicitness which may argue with that, or may, you know, where they say, oh, but it's not really like that, or, oh, wait, I'm stopping to picture this. And so there's an element in which I just, in the struggle to know how to write about sex, which is a big struggle for everybody, and much has been written on the subject, I have definitely, I wouldn't say erred in the direction, but moved in the direction of leaving a lot up to the imagination, you know, not getting into the mechanics too much. Though there are a couple stories that you're not quoting from that have a little bit of the mechanical in them, though not the anatomical mechanical. But the other thing also, I think, has to do with what kind of stories these are. And with a real recognition that the focus on the particular physical activity of sex was going to freight these stories very heavily, that it's almost a disproportionate focus on a physical act as opposed to the focus of these stories, which really is more interior, more interpersonal on a different level. Similarly, there is quite a bit of death and maiming and all kinds of other things in here. You won't find physical descriptions of that either. So there is, and arguably it's a challenge for me as a writer to get more in the body in the next book. But this is not a book that's very much in the body in general, I would say.
On the subject of these maimings, I mean, there are several car crashes, several accidents. It's almost as if it takes something that catastrophic with which to get the characters galvanized. And I'm curious why this was a recurrent method for these stories.
I think that is where the autobiographical piece comes in. I wrote somewhere else that the complaint that one might have about this book, and it sort of depends, I think, on one's own personal history, but there are those who say, you know, oh, every story is about loss, and she should have written a couple to lighten it up. And the reality is that these stories were written over a period of time in which my own life was really quite well scattered with some very tragic situations, and this is what I could do. So it's not, there wasn't an intellectual decision like, boy, what I think makes a story is somebody dies. It was more that the issue that the focus of the book for me is not really the tragic events. The focus of the book from my perspective is how and why people have the creativity to move forward from those events. And to be frankly, you know, just very honest about it, that was an issue I was dealing with in my own life. And I think that in many ways, the stories for me were rehearsals of learning how it is one moves forward after tragedy.
Yeah. Is this why several of the stories deal with older characters, that essentially these particular stories were almost thought experiments with which to imagine, well, okay, I may have experienced this tragedy in my early life. Where am I going to be 20, 30 years from now?
They're actually, the reason for the focus on, and it's older women largely, is that I think that the most interesting people I meet are older women. So from a character perspective, I just find older women to be fascinating. And in particular, if you think about what we were discussing about in my work before, about sort of the way things appear to be and the way things are, the way that older women are looked at in society, which is to say barely at all, you know, and the degree to which women do become increasingly invisible as they outlive societal notions of what's sexy and why one might look at a woman. There's a wonderful discrepancy between what people think they're looking at when they look at older women and what's actually going on in that woman's life and in her consciousness. And anytime you have characters who are leading essentially undercover lives, you have tremendous fictional potential. So I'm just endlessly fascinated by women in their 60s, 70s, 80s, by what's actually going on with them emotionally, intellectually, sexually, by the fact that they continue to live these completely full lives and are so neglected societally. So the focus on older women really has less to do with trying to imagine myself in that place as just being very grateful for this wealth of character that's out there.
I also wanted to ask you, I mean, since we're on the subject of drawing from one's personal station in life and how the narrative that one produces reflects that to some degree, I wanted to ask you about the really explicit communicative disconnect in two stories. In The Guide, there's one moment where Jack is nodding assent versus vocalizing a no. And, of course, in Immortalizing John Parker, you have the title character who remains absolutely silent for most of the story. And so I'm curious if that was a scenario in which communicative disconnect, being an integral part of these respective characters, had to be explicitly laid down or set down like that, or if you were also contemplating within the course of these narratives your own, I suppose, vantage point where you were in your life, or were these, or how, I mean, how did these particular characters get there with such explicitly defined communicative disconnect?
I think that I hope for every writer some of the answer is, you know, I don't know.
Yeah.
I just put it there. But I do think that from a technical perspective, it's the way we are. We don't say everything. I think that stories where characters are represented as just telling each other everything, talking to each other, in a sense, the story, everybody begins to blend together, and the story becomes just about the story. And one of the ways of keeping the people distinct is the recognition of that gap of what isn't said, that they're not participating, they're not just there for the story, they're not just there to share the communications that are going to move the plot along in some way. They're actually there having thoughts that they aren't sharing. They're there resisting. In a sense, the characters themselves are resisting what the author may be trying to get them to do or get them to say. And, you know, maybe I've just spent a lot of time in my life not telling people stuff. But to me, it's the natural course of any conversation involves a good deal of reticence and holding back and strategizing about what it is you are going to share, what it is you aren't. Is this the time to say it? Is this not? Dishonesty. People are dishonest with each other constantly in small, harmless, large, harmful ways. So I guess that because I am somebody who's at least as interested in the interior of human beings as I am in the manifested exterior, that's just a necessary part of it.
Yeah.
Is hiding stuff.
Would this also explain some of the crutch words that we find among these characters in the stories? Just near the end of If I Loved You, and So What, as a charming explanation for Harris's charm in Gaining Ground, and then, of course, Wine in Vine. Would a similar explanation be in effect for this, too?
Well, I'm gonna have to think that one through for a second. I think that there's in all the stories, there's gonna be a high consciousness of language, because I just am. You know, so if anything, when I write, I have to be very careful to make sure that my characters are not as obsessed, you know, not sort of uniformly obsessed with the significance of a particular word or a particular phrase, because for whatever reasons, I am.
Yeah.
So I could go on for pages about the phrase "so what" or "just" or.
Yeah.
So I think some of those things you really do just get the character of the author seeping through. And then the trick as you mature as a writer, and I think I'm going to get better and better at this, and it's one of the real tricks with a novel where you're asking people to put up with your obsessions of a language for 300 pages, not 30, is learning to tone that stuff down some. But there is a certain amount of focus on individual phrases, because that's the way my mind works.
Yeah. This leads me to also ask you about your tendency to reveal the surname of a character after you've established one character, and then there's a break, and then all of a sudden, then we have the surname of the character who we've just been introduced to. Just to give you some examples, immortalizing John Parker, we learn Catherine Parker's last name only when Clara is forced to confront the particular job at hand, and the same goes for Cliff Couric in Tableau Vivant. And in Gaining Ground, the narrator refers to her husband as Harris, which could either be a first name or a surname. It's an odd question, I know, but I am curious as to your relationship with surnames in these stories and why they have a tendency to essentially be, you know, it's almost like you're memorializing, or the character needs to have a surname in order to be real. I that's the sense at least I get from these stories.
It has to do with some of that. It also has to do with narrative distance. There's, I think, and I may get this wrong, but I think in A Country Where You Once Lived, you go through an entire page or so talking about the central character, Jeremy, and then there's white space, and then the next sentence is the reason Jeremy Piper has.
Yeah.
And it's a trick I learned in reverse from Virginia Woolf. And what she does at the beginning of Mrs. Dalloway is the story begins with her as, in one gorgeous page, I think she's Mrs. Dalloway first, then she's Clarissa Dalloway, then she's Clarissa, which is this sort of wonderful way of increasing the narrative intimacy with the character as that page progresses. In some ways, in a story like A Country Where You Once Lived, I wanted the slight intimacy of only using a first name in the beginning, and then there's a slightly different narrative voice after that white space, a narrator that's pulled away from his consciousness. So the reason Jeremy Piper, and at that point he becomes a figure in a story.
Yeah.
And so it's a lot of work, and I'm not sure I always get it right, but it's a lot of work with how close to the consciousness of the point of view character am I here? And the closer, you know, people don't think of themselves with their last names except maybe Bob Dole, but, you know, and then when I want the narrator to sound a little bit more removed from the consciousness of that character and more as though they're talking about them. Or if it's somebody like Clara Parker in immortalizing Clara Feinberg and immortalizing John Parker, it's how she thinks of her. She thinks of her as Catherine Parker. They're not friends. And I think toward the end, she actually is referred to as Catherine. And there's a slightly greater intimacy. So for me, it's about relationships and intimacy.
But it clearly has the reader in mind, because the reader starts the story and thinks that they know the particular person they're reading, and then all of a sudden, well, wait a minute, this person, you're really not on a first name basis with them, because, I mean, it's almost as, I mean, it works with this disparity between two extremes that we were talking about. And in fact, I actually wanted to ask you about the tendency sometimes to have characters really sitting down and enjoying twilight, so this crepuscular light that's coming in, or the dying light, that this is the only way that they can actually find some way to essentially zero their own personal need, and how that came about.
Yeah, I'm trying to think. I can think of one. I'm trying to think of other examples of
It's immortalizing John Parker. Clara describes how she and George really like the light. And there was one other story, but
I'm sure there is. I imagine it's an unconscious being drawn to something transitional. I mean, that dusk is a transitional moment. And an unmooring one to some extent. You know, there's that point in dusk where you think you've seen everything clearly, and everything is about to be obscured, and you're kind of losing it. You have to give into that loss of clarity as the night emerges. So I think with any number of these things, you know, these are things that are metaphorically live inside me. And I can give you an example of the kind of thing where you go back as a writer and you go, oh my, how did I do that in 6 of 10 stories? I have never written a first-person narrative in which at some point the narrator did not say, I don't know. And I've had to go back through stories and cross it out because it's just such a nervous tick on my part. And it's not a nervous tick isn't exactly right. It has to do with my essential understanding that when we tell stories, we can come up with theories about what happened. We can come up with ideas about why they're significant. In essence, when you tell a story, you really don't know. You're putting it together. You're making sense. I mean, my sort of goal as a person, apart from the stories, is to try to make sense of what happens in the world. I mean, I think most of us are doing that. So my basic stance toward the world is, I don't know. And when I write first-person narratives, it always comes through. And it's not, you know, somebody could read 6 of them in a row and say, you know, like, why does she do that? And it's not at all a craft thing. It's like a leakage. So it may be that from a non-craft perspective, I'm just drawn to the idea of the setting sun.
Yeah. Well, I also wanted to ask you, I mean, while we're on the subject of first-person versus third-person, Tableau Vivant is probably the closest omniscient voice out of all the third-person stories. I mean, you start reading this thing and it could almost be first-person, and then you realize, oh, no, it's actually not third-person. And I'm curious as to why this story really amped up the closeness, unlike the other third-persons. Was this a formalistic desire on your part to just really see if you can merge that or blur that boundary between first and third?
It was not. I mean, I can tell you that. And there is a moment in the beginning where that breaks, where the description of her comes up. And again, it gets to the last name thing you were talking about, because she's Jean in the beginning. Yeah. And then there's this one quite third-person moment where it's this thing like, Jean Couric looked a bit like a field mouse herself, yeah, which is definitely a pulled-out moment. After that, I think I was just very in her head, I think in part because I felt that that was a story a lot about what she was trying not to see. And it's a story about a woman whose husband is aging and dying, presumably, and there are implications for it in her life, implications like the fact that they are never going to have sex again, like the fact that there's also a daughter having an affair that she doesn't quite want to see. So to get that that sense of slight befuddledness, in a way I needed to be close in on her, because if I was a little farther out, there'd be a level of clarity of circumstance that I really didn't want there.
I'm curious if, for example, some of the technical needs for these stories interferes with pursuing the human needs of the characters. I mean, to offer an example, this particular story, features third or threes quite frequently. I spotted a number of them. Jean lives in third-tier cities. She describes her cottage as nestled in the crook of three hills. And then there's the meals she cooks, in which no dish had more than five ingredients or fewer than three layers. And I'm curious, when something like this repeats, how the technical something, a technical need for to repeat a word relates to the need to figure out where these characters are, what they are, what their needs are, or whether there really is no bifurcation, that essentially it's one fused act of creation on your part.
I hope there's no bifurcation. You know, writers are drawn to threes. And I actually make a very conscious attempt, because people always list things in threes. You know, the chair, the couch, and the table. He was old, wise, and tired. I mean, there's this sort of three. And I always try to not do that. I do twos or fours as much as I possibly can to break that expected rhythm. I think that the threes in there, and at some point I did become conscious of them, there's that entire story has a level on which it's a play on fairy tales. And there are some very explicit references to the three little pigs,
yeah,
which is in there. And so I don't, in these stories anyway, there are none in here where there are sort of formalistic experiments that have more to do with the form than the character. These are very much character-based stories. In that one, I'm not even sure I was aware of all the threes, but there was this little part of me that understood that I was playing with fairy tale images, with roses, with thorns, with serpents, with the three little pigs. So it's possible that in that one there's a touch of that, you know, that sort of other agenda. But I try very hard not to let those things get in the way. Unless, and there aren't any in this book, but I certainly have stories where I'm doing a formal, there's a formalistic project going on, in which case you're, from the beginning, you're sort of deciding that that will take some precedence, or at least compete with the issues of just sort of psychological character development.
This leads me to also ask about how you prioritize a repeat motif. For example, a country where you once lived, Zoe is making potato salad, and that knife sound, which is later described as the only sound in the room, is the rhythmic rasp of Zoe's knife. I mean, you really become aware of that particular sound, and you really become aware of the fact that she's slicing potatoes, elliptical objects, into, you know, halves. And I'm curious as to at what point along the way do you prioritize a scenario like this, or is this purely subconscious, something like that?
No, I think in many cases what I'm doing when I prioritize something like that is, again, it goes to character. It's what her father sees. It's that he is seeing a knife, which is thematically makes sense given their relationship, and he is seeing her both as wielding something which could be, I mean, I could have made it a potato peeler, right? I made it a knife because there is a sense of danger in their relationship. There's a sense of were bonds cut or not cut, and there's also a sense of fantasy / concern he has about her hurting herself with it. So there is a conscious level, but the level is less about where I want to draw the reader's attention as to what I want to reveal about the fact that he is so focused on the knife, when he could be focused on, you know, the view out the window, the tablecloth, the lovely flowers in the corner. What he's seeing is his daughter wielding a knife.
Yeah.
So it's really about, I think probably 9 times out of 10, if not more, the physical descriptions of objects are filtered through what characters themselves are seeing.
Does this often pose a certain kind of creative frustration? Because if you are looking at a room through one character, and you know that that particular character has his blinders on. Therefore, you're probably, as the writer, you're going to be saying, oh, God, I want to know what the rest of the room is, but I can't actually look at that, or I know certain aspects of this that he doesn't know. Do you experience anything along those lines? Or?
Well, you have to remember that when I started, I couldn't write scenes at all or scenery. I write scenes, not scenery. So I rarely feel that kind of, boy, I wish I could describe. You know, I seem to have been born without the impulse to want to tell you what the rug looks like. So I don't feel that frustration. I think in my case, it's more the danger with descriptions of objects and scenery in general is that I will give them too much psychological significance, that every object I describe is performing some kind of job, so that it's almost as though the objects themselves have consciousnesses. And it's very funny because I could hardly be farther from a writer of magical realism, except that when I actually go through some of the stories and I look at the degree to which the objects are expressionistic, that they're really creating so much of the emotional landscape, I've discovered a kind of funny intersect between traditional magical realism and this very kind of cut and dried, unsentimental, prosaic prose I write that has this funny way of drifting into that, because the staircase is a serpent and the streetlights are having arguments with each other, and there's a way in which I discovered an ability to write landscape and scenery through making it into characters, which is what I'm much more comfortable writing. But then I have to be careful. Otherwise, you really do end up with sort of a Disney scene where all the objects are running around and the candlesticks are serving you dinner. And so I kind of try to watch it that way.
Maybe some of this unexpected sentience that you feel is essentially conveyed through the belief system of characters wanting to believe or not believe other people, that this is the way to, I suppose, obviate this concern, steeping it in perspective.
And I think, as I said before, you know, I am somebody who is sort of hell-bent on finding significance in everything, and I view myself very much, my sort of primary description of myself is an interpreter. I am constantly, in my own mind and in my work, interpreting what's going on, why is it happening, what does it really mean, what might it mean. And I think, again, I am often a little bit in danger of giving all my characters that same characteristic. So it is, you know, it's all of a piece. And I think all writers probably realize at some point that their strengths and their potential weaknesses spring from the same place. And I think that some of the things that are strongest about my work when it's working, which has to do with understanding why things are happening or giving a kind of decent interpretation of human behavior, can go way overboard if I'm not careful, you know. So they're all things I have to be constantly pulling in.
Yeah.
Or that just gets tiresome. But hopefully it hasn't in this book. That's the hope anyway.
Well, that seems a very good note to end this conversation. Robin, thanks so much for being here. It was a pleasure.
Thank you. A real pleasure.
Why you and I have got to part. I tell you, baby, I've told you before, with each day passing,